Hi, I am Liza Mundy. I'm a staff writer for the Washington Post, and I've written a couple of books, including a book called Everything Conceivable, that is a look at assisted reproduction technology and the many ways in which it has changed the composition and dynamics of the family. And I'm going to be chatting today with Randy Hutter Epstein, who has written a very interesting book on the history of childbirth called Get Me Out. And so I'm going to hand it over to you for a sec, Randy, to introduce yourself and just give us an introduction and an overview of your book.
Sure. Okay. I'm Randy Hutter Epstein, and I'm a physician, non-practicing, so I'm an MD, journalist, and mother of four, and just wrote this book, as you said, Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth. And I guess I got into it because of my background. I've always had this interest in childbirth and started to investigate and thought, wow, this is a really fascinating history. And two of the things that struck me while doing it is I really thought that driving ourselves crazy with all this conflicting advice was just something of modern medicine or baby boomers. And as I started working on the book and looking into the history of it all, I realized, well, no, there's two things. One is that we've been bombarded with advice for forever, except for Eve. She's the only person because she doesn't have a mother or sisters or guidebooks. But ever since Eve, we've been flooded with advice, and we've done anything to try to figure out which advice to listen to. And the other thing is we've also always done anything we could to try to control what I call this uncontrollable situation. So, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, it was think happy thoughts, have really good sex. And now it's pick the right sperm, get the best egg, and get the best womb to put them all in together. So that's sort of my two running themes.
Yes, it definitely emerges through your book how consistent some of these patterns have been throughout history. And as far as controlling the uncontrollable, I think it's understandable that we would want to do so, given historically how dangerous childbirth has been for women. You mentioned Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, who died in childbirth. And I thought a lot about this when I had my own children. I have a 14-year-old daughter and an 11-year-old son, and I remember when my daughter was born and I went through childbirth and left the hospital in a day, because that's what insurance companies thought we'd do back then. I thought a lot about my great-grandmother, my grandfather's mother, who did die in childbirth.
And that was what year?
Well, it was 1900, and she died of childbed fever, presumably because of the doctor. I don't know whether she was in a hospital or more likely at home. They were not a well-to-do family. My grandfather was the youngest of five, and she died, I think, a day or two after he was born. He was raised by her sister, who moved in with them to take care of the boys, and eventually married his father and raised them as her own sons. But, you know, this poor woman in her 20s or maybe her early 30s gave birth to her fifth son, and then that was the last we heard of her, and we know very little about her, and she was really lost to history. And so... This is, as I said, it's no wonder, I think, that we try to control the uncontrollable, because it is a dangerous experience and it's a frightening experience.
Right. And around that time, I mean, the diaries that we have from women around that time, they were scared to death. I mean, some women would write notes, you know, if I don't make it through this pregnancy, you know, diaries from the 1880s, 1890s. And the other interesting thing is, especially when you talk about 1900, and I have it in the book, by 1900, we knew what caused, I mean, well, we pretty much knew, most people knew that germs caused childbed fever. You know, 50 years before that, we didn't. But by 1900, we knew you had to wash your hands. We knew what prevented it. But still, nothing changed maternal mortality until we had got antibiotics. So it kind of shows you we're not good at prevention. We're good once there's a pill to cure us. And then there were all sorts of weird things, especially before 1880, before we knew about germs, that, you know, we had no idea what was killing these women. We have no idea why they'd spike a fever. So they tried all sorts of things. I found this medical record or a letter from a doctor that was written in a New York City hospital from the early 1800s, which they called the cure to childbed fever. And basically they took this woman and they put her on this stringent diet of no food. She had just given birth, had a fever, seemed really sick. So they told her no food, just water and whiskey. I guess the whiskey was supposed to clean her out. They drew blood from her. They gave her stuff that made her vomit just to get all the toxins out. And then they brought her up with some other women to the roof of the hospital where they aired her out because they thought maybe something with the fresh air would just get rid of whatever was killing her. And somehow the woman survived. So this was written up as we finally found a cure to childbed fever. But basically there's all sorts of odd things that women, you know, not only did they get the fever, but then they had to live through, help to try to survive the remedies that were going on.
Now, was childbed fever something that happened before doctors got involved in the childbirth process, or did they pretty much bring it?
It must have. You know, there were midwives going from house to house. So it wasn't just doctors. Midwives passed. You know, whoever, if you were delivering one baby and you got your hands infected and then you went on to do someone else. So it's always been around. But even still, we have no idea. Even when it was what we considered epidemic and even when women were dying, we don't have the statistics because they didn't keep records. I think England started keeping records in the late 1800s. You know, a few states started keeping records around then. But, you know, if you go back and try to figure out exactly how many women were killed by childbed fever, you don't know. We didn't keep death records. Then we did. We didn't specify that it was childbed fever. So we really have no idea. It was a tragedy. It was horrible because you were healthy one day, you were about to become a mother, and then you were dead. So, you know, word got out if someone died and you heard about people, but we have no idea how epidemic. And then again, there were instances where you'd hear in one maternity hospital, five women, or in one town. So you'd hear of it spreading from, you know, parturient woman to, you know, laboring woman. You'd hear it spreading. But we really don't know about the numbers.
And, of course, there are all sorts of other reasons historically why women have died in childbirth or children have died.
You were bleeding to death. The baby was stuck. They couldn't get out. There's a number of reasons why things didn't turn out well.
And you talk in your book about why it is that childbirth is so dangerous for humans. I mean, plenty of animal species are able to carry it off quite effortlessly. A couple years ago, our cat had two kittens behind a chair in about 30 seconds, and 1 minute they were there, 1 minute they weren't there, one minute they were. But we have an unusually difficult time of it, and it talk about why that is.
Well, I spoke to an anthropologist while I was doing the book, and the bottom line is, you know, if you walk on all fours and you have a really wide hip, and you're giving birth to a species that has a tiny head, things will be easier. But once humans stood up and we didn't want to waddle or however you call gorillas when they walk around, you know, sort of hunched over, once we started standing up straight and our pelvises got narrower and then we got smarter so then our heads got bigger, it made for, I guess, we're better off as a species to be able to walk and run and think more thoughts, but it doesn't help with the childbirth process. So we're talking big head coming out of a small circle.
Yes, and obviously, thanks to modern medicine in the first world, it has gotten a lot safer. I mean, so safe that we pretty much expect that we're going to survive childbirth.
Oh, right.
But along the way, as you show, although sort of in the long run, medicine has made it a lot safer, along the way, there have been some fairly dramatic mistakes or ways in which medicine has inflicted done more harm than good, I think it's fair to say.
Well, I think in modern times, the big tragedy that I write about in the book is DES.
Yeah.
And that was this drug that was given to women to prevent miscarriages. And not only did we find out 20 years later, it took 20 years, that not only was it not effective, but we found out that any baby who's been exposed to it, if your mother took DES, there's a good chance you're infertile. There's a good chance that you have some cervical changes. And there's a small chance, but women have had this, that you get vaginal cancer. So it's been a real tragedy. Now, DES is not the same drug as the other screw-up that we have, thalidomide. Thalidomide was the drug that women took to prevent morning sickness. And those women gave birth to physically deformed babies. So that was noticed right away. The thalidomide was never approved in America thanks to a very cautious FDA, a woman who was running the FDA at the time. So any Americans, I think there were 26 that took DES were living overseas. But that was, you know, that they knew right away. DES babies looked fine. And you know, if you think about it, part of the reason why I have it in my book is to look at, you know, why were we taking these pills? What were we doing when there was no proof? But DES came on the scene in the 50s, and You know, if you go back to the 50s, we were probably more optimistic in the 50s about modern medicine and science than we ever were and ever will be. So if your doctor said to you, I've got this pill, it's going to prevent miscarriages, and if you had had a miscarriage, like, you'd take it. You weren't doing searches. You did not go home and read up everything about that pill and then start questioning your doctor. And you also thought, because the way most doctors thought, that nothing crossed the placenta. They called it the placental barrier. So you thought anything you took, there's no way. And then if your baby was born healthy, there was not even a thought that somehow a pill that you took could affect your baby 20 years from then. And I bet if someone said to their doctor, do you think I have to worry that this pill I'm taking during pregnancy might somehow affect my developing child? And it wouldn't occur to you to ask the question, and your doctor would have thought, you know, you were some sort of weird faith healer.
Although you point out in your book that it was a husband and wife team at Harvard who were really promoting DES and confident that it both prevented miscarriage and was safe. And that there were pretty early on some researchers at institutions that were somewhat less prestigious who were questioning DES.
And, oh, people questioned DES all
and
along.
And that it was Harvard team and their sort of prestige and their sometimes pompous self-certainty who said, no, you know, this was done at the University of Chicago. It couldn't be, you know, as reliable as the trials we did. And basically sort of batted away the concerns and were enabled by the pharmaceutical industry to, which wanted to continue peddling this stuff so that, in fact, concerns were raised. And it was sold and peddled and sometimes given to women without their realization for 20 years, even so.
Yep. And another thing I'll point out, which is just a minor part of this story, but in 1959, it's a footnote in the book, but in 1959, poultry workers, they were giving DES to chickens to beef them up and make them heartier chickens, and poultry workers who were, like, nibbling on the necks of these chickens started to grow breasts and I think had some other health issues. And when they looked into it, they said, oh, gosh, we should really stop giving DES to poultry. So in 1959, DES was banned from chickens, but not banned for pregnant women until 1971. And, yeah, you're right. People were writing letters. I went through the archives of the Smiths, and that was the team at Harvard. And they did. There were a lot of letters, handwritten letters from researchers from all over the world saying, yeah, I don't know, my animal studies kind of look like high doses of estrogen might spur cancers. This might not be the best thing. And invariably they would write back, the wife usually would write back and say, no, our theory works, we know. And they were very bright people. And they would write back and say, you know, you really have to follow our protocol to the T. They had it exactly right, you know, how much DES on each day. And the other interesting thing is, yeah, there was a big study in Chicago, and it didn't show that DES was dangerous, but it showed it was ineffective. And the drug companies ignored the results of that study, obviously, but the drug companies, you know, will call the Smiths and say, do you need more drugs? We'll give you free handouts. And they promoted the Smith studies. You know, all the results of the Smith studies that showed DES were safe were reprinted in ads. So, yeah, the whole thing. I mean, it was just this sort of perfect storm in some way of all these things coming together.
And then, as you point out, I mean, that was, you talk in your book that there was sort of the era of men with tools, like, you know, when forceps were invented and there was a group of doctors who guarded the design, a family of the doctors who guarded the design of their forceps and other tools that came into being, like the speculum. And so there was the era of men with tools, and then this gave way to the era of men with drugs or in women with drugs, doctors with drugs. And It was things like the DES episode that really called into question the authority of doctors and the validity of drugs, and then would lead to these natural childbirth movements. So there was kind of swinging back and forth.
Yeah, we're always swinging back and forth, and it's kind of interesting with the DES, because DES came on the scene in the 50s when we had all these high hopes for medicine.
Right, better living through chemistry.
Yes, exactly. You know, formula's better, McDonald's is better than home cooking. You know, everything was sort of better if it was sort of pre-made and scientific. And so that's when DES came on the scene. So probably if DES came on the scene at a different time, maybe it wouldn't have been as popular. And then again, we found out the study that proved that linked DES to vaginal cancer was published in 1971 in the New England Journal of Medicine. And I spoke to the woman who really sort of got the whole DES activist group going. And she says, you know, maybe if the bad results came on the scene in 1971, when people were starting to get, or already, you know, civil rights movement, second wave feminist movement. So when she sat at her kitchen table and said, oh my God, this is horrible, we have to fight against this drug, she had women from all over the country saying, sure, we'll help you. We'll start, you know, mailing out newsletters. We'll group, you know, we'll band together. And she had said to me, she wonders, you know, if the bad news came out in 1958, would she have gotten this strong group that's still going strong today? It's a global network, still going strong. She doesn't think so. In some ways, you know, it sort of worked both to promote DES in the 50s, and then the 70s really helped to sort of go against it. And there are historians and sociologists that feel like the whole tragedy of DES really got the women's health movement going, because it was this one thing that got women together to say, you know what, we can't trust everything our doctors tell us, and we really have to start being informed about what's going on.
Although one of the things that you talk about when you talk about the natural childbirth movement, a number of the architects of that movement were men.
Were wacky.
And of course, one of the popularizers in this country was Elizabeth Bing, so there was definitely a woman who was behind it. But it's interesting to me that the men who sort of confidently promoted natural childbirth were not people who had gone through it themselves, and in some cases held the view that labor pain is just a female delusion, presumably a manifestation of hysteria or female weakness or neurasthenia.
Not all the women. I mean, not all the promoters, the early men, but yeah, Grantley Dick Reed, who was the original, you know, guy that got this up and running, and he was not liked by a lot of doctors. He wasn't even an OBGYN. He wasn't board certified. He refused to take the board exam. He was hated by his colleagues in England. But yeah, he's got this whole thing going. He got the idea from, it originally went back to Pavlov and his dogs. You know, if you can get a dog to drool from the sound of a bell, maybe we can figure out some way to get women to stop complaining from, you know, breathing, or some way to get them over childbirth. So that's how it originally came about, you know, this Pavlovian thing. And he promoted it as, one, to help all these neurotic and uptight women be able to give birth the way poor Christian women can. And, yes, and again, he thought it was sort of God's way. It was the Christian way of giving birth, was without drugs. But when he came to America, he had all these wonderful followers. And a few doctors picked up and said, okay, we're not into the neurotic women thing, and we're not into the Christian thing, but these concepts of maybe using less drugs and using fewer drugs and getting women to relax, that might be okay. And the other interesting thing about it is natural childbirth really didn't start in the 70s. It became this huge movement in the 70s, but it really got started in the 40s and 50s, but a lot of people don't remember those days. But the doctors in the 40s and 50s that were behind the natural childbirth, some of them were really into this whole new Freudian psychoanalytic concepts. So they looked at the whole emotional thing, and they were looking at it from, some of them from this psychiatric point of view, that it's healthier for you mentally to be awake and alert during birth, and it's healthier for the baby not to have drugs through them and to be able to come right out and have the mom hug them, and it started the whole rooming in movement. So this was really being promoted sort of when psychiatry was having its heyday also.
One of the things just related to Grantley Dick Reed's idea that labor pains were a female delusion that could be willed away, particularly if she embraced her domestic and maternal destiny, is just the idea that as long as human beings have been sort of meditating on the pain of labor, they've been inclined to think women must deserve it for some reason. Mm-hmm. Either it's a delusion and it doesn't really exist, or it does exist and we somehow deserve it. I mean, obviously this...
Like a hazing process. Like if you're going to be a mom, you better be able to withstand
it. Right, that's right. If you are going to be a mom, you might as well get used to the pain of motherhood now. But also even biblically, the idea mm-hmm. that Eve's punishment for disobedience was that she would give forth children from now on in pain and suffering. I mean, that's...
I know, which is so bizarre.
Talk about blaming the victim.
I know, and talk about, like, that the punishment had nothing to do with the crime.
Yes, yes, right, yes.
Right. But you could, where did they come up with
you
that?
You could just see sort of all these male authorities sitting around saying, that looks really painful. Why would that be so painful? She must have done something to deserve that level of pain. So it's just sort of an extraordinary lack of sympathy and inclination to blame the victim.
I mean, and it is weird because we laugh about, you know, we can look back generations and say, gosh, look at these people, you know, saying this is the way you should give birth. And it's, you know, it's anti-whatever Christian, anti-Judaic, whatever, to have drugs during pregnancy or to ask for them. But even today, you bring up, I mean, we all know, you bring up childbirth and people either are proud that they did it naturally or women feel that they're being judged if they say, well, actually, I wanted that epidural. I mean, even today, there's this feeling of, like, that you were copping out if you wanted to, like, not feel pain during childbirth.
That's exactly it. And that's one of the themes, I think, that is consistent throughout your book, is the level of ideology and judgmentalism that has been inflicted on women throughout history by men and by women. I mean, just as you say, if you're sitting there breastfeeding your baby in Nordstrom and there's somebody next to you and you get on the topic of whether you have the epidural or not, you know, Lord help you.
Breastfeeding or bottle feeding.
Right. Lord help you if you did have the epidural and the person that you're sitting next to didn't. Because
and they're more valiant.
They are, yes, they are more valiant. And this is consistently true throughout.
And the other consistent thing, and you know, and it's always easy to laugh at, you know, things that our great grandmothers did. But anyone that gives birth and that there's something wrong with the baby, whether they admit it or not, you think, okay, what did I do during my pregnancy? What did I do? Was I too stressed? Did I work too much? And, you know, granted, you know, in the 40s and 50s and 60s, they actually might have said to you, you know, wait, you were working during your pregnancy? You know, wait, you're a lawyer? You know, of course, you know, that's why things screwed up. But now, I'm telling you, any woman that something doesn't go perfect, they're thinking, you know, well, gosh, was I too stressed? What was I doing? Did I not eat right? And, you know, so we're always sort of blaming ourselves and we think about things that might not have any control over it. We shouldn't, maybe that vegetarian thing would have been better. Maybe I did eat too much sugar. You know, so we're constantly driving ourselves crazy and we constantly think that we're going to control it. We're going to control it through our diet, through our thoughts, through our whatever.
And is this unusually true, do you think, of pregnancy and childbirth compared to other medical procedures or?
It's interesting you said. The other reason why I started the book wasn't so much childbirth, but I was always interested in this gray zone area of medicine. And I call it the gray zone where a doctor tells you something to do and there's not really a study, but it just makes sense, you know, whether you should rest after a heart attack or you rehab after a heart attack or whatever the going advice is. So I really started looking into those gray areas. And the reason why I tended toward childbirth was I think it is different because you're healthy. The patients are healthier. So that means that you're more empowered and you're more likely to say, this is the way I think it should be done. When, you know, when you're sick, you feel too sick to say, this is the way I think it should be done.
I guess what I was thinking about is it used to be the case that cancer was considered a sort of a shameful condition that people wouldn't talk about it or wouldn't talk about why somebody in the family had died. And I think sometimes people who are battling against or undergoing a serious illness also get all sorts of commentary. Well, if you just, I mean, as Barbara Ehrenreich has written, you know, if you just think positive, you should be able to overcome
this. Exactly. Go for a run. Go for like the cure breast cancer run. And that'll
right. So it's not uniquely true of childbirth, but it still, it is striking reading your history, you know, how much judgmentalism has been inflicted.
No, I mean, I hope that my story is sort of a slice of medicine and sort of will open people up into doctor. I mean, I look at it as doctor-patient relationships. And I look at it as a medical history through childbirth, but I definitely think it tells the story of other things that go on. But I do think the difference is for most cancer patients, you just feel weaker, you know, and you don't feel, we're not all Barbara Ehrenreich, you know, can be that force, you know, speak up to her doctors that much. And a lot of women who are pregnant don't feel that they can speak up to their doctors, but more do because you're healthier. Or you have an image of what it should be.
Right. And we speak up because we feel much more empowered now to speak up to our doctors.
Right.
One of the things, one of the other themes that emerges in your book is this consistent view that middle class and upper middle class women are sort of over civilized and too refined to really withstand childbirth. And this is why they need the drugs, or this is why they need the forceps, or these days this is why they need the C-sections because they're too posh to push. But that poor women are sort of wonderfully well equipped.
Right, because they don't complain.
Right, right. Yeah. And in particular, during, say, in the antebellum period, you write about the fact that it was viewed that black women did not feel labor pains to the extent that white women did. And this, one of the to me, most riveting and painful parts of your book is when you talk about the doctor, J. Marion Sims, who experimented on a group of slave women in his ambitious attempt, and I gather a successful attempt, to develop a cure for fistula. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about him.
I mean, he, to this day, is still debated by historians. Like, how do we look at this guy who did? He achieved a huge success for women. I mean, he figured out how, you know, what thread to use, how to successfully sew up vaginal tears.
And that's what fistula is. It's this awful tear.
Just a tear. Yeah. And he figured out the cure, which nowadays it's no big deal unless you're in a developing country, and it still is actually a big deal. But it's easily fixable, and he figured that out. And there's a statue of him in New York. There's statues of him all over the country that say, what a great guy. You know, he's done wonders. He's just, you know, women's, you know, the greatest thing that happened to women. The part of the story that has been buried until recently, when several historians have sort of unearth this, is that how did he come up with his cure? Well, he got three slave women. He bought them or borrowed them and put them in his quote-unquote hospital, his backyard. He had like a shack in his backyard. And he tried. He sewed them. It didn't work. He did it again. He was sewing and pulling the stitches out, and he would botch things
up. And you point out that he was using a speculum that he had invented that was
made
of spoons he had bought at the hardware store.
Right, yes, he bought two spoons at a hardware store, and that is sort of the shape of the speculum that's used today. So he does, there's a speculum, there's also the Sims position where he put women on their side so he could see better. Oh. And he had so many, he used to have this crowd come and watch, because as much as you weren't allowed to see a naked woman give birth, even the doctors would deliver sort of in the blind. But if you were poor, and especially if you were a slave, and anyone wanted to see, you know, gosh, is that what it looks like? So he had crowds of people in the beginning would come, hold their legs open, watch what was going on. But after he had so many failures, you know, people stopped coming for the show. And someone actually complained. And oddly, their complaint wasn't, oh, my God, look what these women have been through. You've got to stop this. It was, oh, my God, you've got to stop this. You're wasting your time. Your career is going to go down the tubes. No one wants to watch anymore. There's no successes. And, you know, why would you want to spend your career doing this anyhow? So there's no thought to, oh, my God, these poor women.
There weren't any bioethicists back then or medical
ethicists. This is a bad career move for you. And he, in his autobiography, will say, no, I knew that I was on to something great. I knew that I would achieve. He says something, basically, I knew I would achieve the greatest thing that ever happened in medicine, and I did. I mean, I don't know if it's that great, but that's what
But what these women
himself.
Went through, I mean, you point out that one of the slave women he was experimenting on, he stitched her more than 30 times, which is just extraordinary to contemplate.
And there were probably others. Yeah. We have the names of three. Of course, there's no medical records. They weren't keeping diaries. They weren't, you know, you don't really know how they felt. One can only imagine. I think he writes that they volunteered willingly. How willing? We have no idea what was going on. He does, though, mention at one point, he does mention in one of his letters that these women deserve credit. So he wasn't this horrific, you know, he does feel that the women that volunteered deserve credit for the, for his success.
And we don't know what became of them after.
I dug hard to try to find that. No, we know their names and that's it. They didn't keep records. Mm-hmm. I mean, he kept records of what he did to them, but we have no idea. Well, they were probably illiterate. They probably didn't write.
Right.
So we have no idea how they felt.
Yeah. And you have an illustration of one of them being examined.
And it's just a painting.
Yeah.
But we have no idea, you know, where that came, you know, who concocted that.
And you point out, I think, that at that time, and maybe before that, gynecology, being an obstetrician gynecologist, was not really a very exalted branch.
No, the whole
of
thing. Not, I mean, when Sims started out, medicine wasn't. I mean, the great thing was Sims came. Sims' father was he had a store in town, and that's what Sims wanted to do. You know, he was sent to college, and then he decided, I'll work in the family business, which was just a general store down south.
And so that's probably where he got the spoons.
Right, exactly, yeah. And then his dad said, no, you're going to make something of your life. And Sims actually said, well, he didn't think he was smart enough to be a minister or a lawyer, so he'd become a doctor. And his father, and he has it in his autobiography, his father said, if that's what I thought that you were going to do with a college education, I would have never have sent you to college. And he makes some remark, which was true in the early 1800s. He said, you're going to go around from house to house and basically, like, sell this quack remedies. You know, it's not a real profession. Medicine isn't a profession. You have to be either a lawyer or a minister. And he cried and said, you know, he wasn't smart enough, because he did. He used to always have people help him with his homework in college, and he wasn't a great student. So against his, you know, family's belief, but he said he had nothing else to do, he became a doctor. And he even said when he went to a few courses in medical school, because there was no standardized training, he hated all the stuff that he learned about gynecology. It really made him sick to his stomach. And it was considered, of medicine in those days, it was really considered lowly, because why would you specialize in something that, like, these grandmas in your town did?
And you say that sometimes barbers or people who had other professions would deliver babies.
Oh, to make extra money.
Yeah. Well, why then did you talk about, you know, in the 1500s, the Chamberlain family of doctors, and they were the ones who developed the forceps and jealously guarded the design of their forceps. Why did they want to get into the business then? I mean, one of the themes of your book is sort of midwives were doing it all along.
Yeah, and there are these male midwives. It is interesting because all along there were, I mean, the Chamberlains were this family in the late 1500s. You know, going to the 1800s, that was sort of when medicine was starting to become professionalized. And where did obstetrics fit in with medicine? Because it really wasn't part of medicine then. And that was considered lowly.
It was like barbering or something?
Yeah, exactly. But in the late 1500s, there were a few, they called them man midwives, which I always thought was such like a weird thing to call yourself a man midwife.
Why not just be a mid-husband?
I know, or something like
yeah,
that. But there were these people that were man midwives, and they weren't really doctors, but they were professionals, and they thought because they were men and they were smarter, they could be better than the female midwives. And they did, in Europe there was some training. We didn't have it here in America, but even in the early years of America, there wasn't real training for midwives. In Europe early on, some cities did train their midwives. And the Chamberlains, yeah, they decided, well, let's make the best of this trade and try to be the midwives to the royalty.
And so they would get a lot of money then when they would come around with their forceps.
Yes.
and deliver the babies and hopefully get a stuck baby out more successfully.
Right. Then. They charged more than female midwives charge. And they've been known to say they didn't want you if you couldn't afford them. They sort of set up this whole aura of, you know, that they were there for the women who could afford them. And they would say that they had the best forceps that could get the baby out safely. But again, no one did studies then. You know, they went on for generations, 1600s, 1700s, and no one ever did a study. So we have no idea. But it was kind of thought of that if you had a chamberlain with you, that was the safest way to give birth.
So it was word of mouth.
It was totally, it was word of their mouth.
People would hear about the chamberlains, yes, and they would want a part of that.
Right, and then once they got connected to royalty, then, yes, you know, it's the way it is now. You know, oh, wow, that's that celeb doctor. He must be
right. Exactly. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Well, that's true. That probably brings us to fertility medicine.
Ah, yes. Speaking of celebrity doctors.
Exactly.
And expensive things, and things that are really expensive, that are for only people who can afford it. That brings us right up to today in fertility.
Yes, and I suppose that is a convenient segue. I mean, because two of the chapters in your book are devoted to very modern means of conception and sort of sperm banking, which has existed for more than a century. Not so much sperm banking, but donor sperm.
Donor sperm. It was done secretly.
Done secretly. And the first incidence of donor sperm was actually done on a sedated woman who did get pregnant and who never knew that it wasn't her
husband.
Yeah.
Her husband found out later.
Her Her husband did find out, and they apparently never told her.
Yeah, she never knew.
And then it was quietly done for decades, yeah. And often the donor would be the doctor himself or, you know, a couple of medical students.
And up until recently, I mean, I had someone tell me during my book research, who's an OBGYN, she's of Indian descent, and she had this Indian couple, and they could not get pregnant. And she said, she went home and said to her husband, who's not a physician, and she was a predictor. And this goes back, I guess, in the 60s. Could you please donate sperm? And, you know, no one has to know. And at least it would all be, you know, culturally, you know, it would still seem okay. But her husband refused. He didn't want to start having his half genes. But, you know, it's just interesting. But that's really the way it was done up yes. until pretty recently that, you know, a doctor would, you know, say, don't worry, I could try to get your sperm. You don't have to tell anybody. And we'll try to get it to look like your husband.
Right, and nowadays it's quite out in the open, and it's as treatment has gotten better for infertile men.
And as we admit that men can be infertile. I mean, you know, we used to not even admit it.
Right. Now it's single women and often lesbian couples who are availing themselves of sperm banking. You write about IVF as well and embryo creation in the lab and embryo selection. And one of the things that I found when I was researching this area is the way in which, you know, as you say, it is often an attempt to inject some control in the conception process and sometimes in the selection of a sperm or an egg donor to establish some control over the characteristics that your child might have. But it injects a whole new, just as we've gotten to a point where your first world childbirth is a pretty safe endeavor, what has happened with fertility medicine is that it's driven this incredible rise in multiple births and re-injected a whole new level of risk into the process. And this was really a surprise to me when I started reporting because I hadn't really given that much thought to multiple births and to the relative safety or risk of multiple deliveries. But we've seen this incredible rise in neonatal units and high-risk deliveries and cable channels that seem to have an incessant parade of high-risk, often multiple births.
And we don't talk about the risk, though. We talk about the miracle babies.
And most people one-pounders who are saved.
And most people say, oh, don't worry. If your baby's born in a pound, there's so many things they can do. You know, people don't actually go in those NICUs and see. You don't hear about the kids that died. No one wants to talk about it.
But it struck me that we've, over the years, because of the, obviously there have been fits and starts, but because of the incredible advances in safety, we've become a little bit complacent with the idea that sort of doctors can save any baby and can rescue any adverse childbirth situation. And we've created now these extreme birth situations, you know, octuplets in the extreme, but even twins
that you found in your research too, you know, part of it is, yeah, because we're desperate, you know, people that really want kids, they will ignore the downside. They don't want to hear the bad news. And like, oh, so what, you know, my triplets will be fine. And if it's quadruplets, it'll be okay. It's better than nothing. You know, I've got to go. You know, I think they lose perspective of what's going on.
There are also some people who want particularly twins because they've paid a fair amount of money for the IVF process. And they figure if you can get two
for the price of one,
of course. Or go ahead and just be guaranteed your two children.
And from the doctor's perspective, from the clinic's perspective, which is the doctor, it helps their scorecards. They don't want, you know, they keep statistics. Yet they have to keep their statistics up to get more patients. So they want.
So if the odds of success go up by transferring three embryos rather than one or two, then they're more likely to transfer three. Although the odds of even one are getting a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, we're starting to look into it now, but, you know, I don't think there's enough research. It's not where the money is, and it's not what the patients are demanding, and it's not really going to help your statistics. So the motivation is health, but we need someone to come up with a way that we can say, that's the embryo that's going to make a baby. So we don't have to put three embryos and just hope that one of them takes. I mean, some of this is still so rudimentary. Part of my book research, I was talking to sperm researchers. And, you know, when you think about it, you know, how have we always said, you know, when we look at a sperm sample, like, which is the best sperm? Well, the ones that are fast and just seem to, like, really know how to swim. And I talked to a researcher, and he said, you know, some of those loser-looking ones might be your best ones, the ones that are swimming crooked.
Right.
Because he believes, which I would think, too, that there's more to it than just being a fast-rate swimmer.
Yeah, and they really can't tell which are going to be the successful embryos either. And part of that is because of the lack of federal funding for embryo research.
Yeah, I think it's that combined with there hasn't been, there's been a few doctors here and there, but I don't think there's been a huge motivation for doctors to say, gosh, I really just want to put one embryo back in and we're just going to have single babies. You know, I don't think doctors will say that there's the demand for twins. And I also think they're worried that in the process of doing this research, their statistics may go down.
Right, right. Now, one of the things I wondered with regard to just sort of ordinary singleton childbirth, because you really take us through the personalities and the fads, be it, you know, drugs and twilight sleep, which we haven't talked about yet, or be it no drugs, and we really now can look at them historically and look at them at fads and sort of scoff a little bit. But you have to wonder, what are the fads of today? And I guess, you know, my own childbirths are maybe almost now part of an earlier era, although it doesn't feel that way because, I think most women, at least those of us who didn't go through twilight sleep, we remember every minute of it so vividly. But certainly I lived through the era of just kind of incessant testing and, you know, not just amniocentesis or whatever, but blood testing and sort of tests that would raise vague questions that would necessitate other tests, like this thing called a non-stress test that I never understood why it was called a non-stress test. And yet, in my case, despite what seemed like a lot of testing and sometimes test results that got lost and tests that had to be redone and the insurance company, you know, I suppose is the one who was driving these tests, they didn't know that my second child weighed 9.5 pounds compared to my first child who weighed 7.5 pounds.
You're not good. It's usually plus or minus 3 pounds, which is like a lot when you're
I mean, when they do these sonograms, yeah, they're measuring the fetus's limbs and they're saying, well, it's about whatever, you know, so-and-so millimeters. So this means it's about, you know, 27 days. I mean, it seems so precise when they're going through it. And I vividly remember the doctor saying, I think this second baby will be about exactly the same size as your first baby was. And, you know, in fact, he was much larger and maybe I would have had a C-section if they had known. And so it sort of raised in my question, well, all these blood tests and sonograms and non-stress tests, are they really giving doctors useful information, or are they just a CYA type thing against medical malpractice later? And so what are we going to look back at 20 or 40 years from now and say, huh, that was silly?
The tests that we have are good, but they have to be used the right way. You know, I was talking to a doctor about fetal monitoring, and that's sort of the one that everyone always says, you know, we don't need it. We don't need it because it leads to more C-sections. But, you know, there is a point to them. You know, you do fetal monitoring, and then doctors can say, oh, my God, this baby, there's something wrong. You know, it needs to come out. The problem is that, you know, when you're monitoring the fetus through the fetal monitoring and they put the measuring thing, you know, they attach it to its head, you know, there's always little glitches that most doctors can see. Okay, that's a little glitch. Everything's going fine. There was just whatever, a little hiccup or whatever, you know, and they'll know the difference between a glitch and then something serious. You know, a doctor can interpret that. The fear now is that if you don't do a C-section, or should you not do something, that strip from the fetal monitor will end up in a court, and any little glitch, you know, a lawyer will say, well, they'll circle it and say, well, look at this, something should have been done. And even when a doctor says, well, that wasn't really a serious one, that, you know, the doctors rightly have this fear that, you know, the jury's going to say, what do you mean? Didn't you see like it dipped down? You know, people that can't interpret it. So that's the fear among doctors, is that they have this good technology, and you can, and a lot of people, they don't talk about it a lot, but a lot of people do have these stories of, wow, you know, this was going on, or the doctor noticed this, and thank God I was in a hospital, my baby was saved. And it's interesting because I think now we're sort of in this era of extremes, and I've interviewed a lot of people, and I've had stories of people saying, you know, thank God for the fetal monitor, thank God I was in the hospital, you know, who would have known, everything was going along smoothly, and then the doctor noticed something, and they were able to fix it, or they did this ultrasound, and they noticed, you know, something wrong with the baby's heart, they did the surgery in utero, the baby came out fine. There's amazing things that are going on now. And then, but then there are also a ton of people that I spoke to that said, all that's overkill, and it's just making the whole experience more stressful, and stress has an effect on your pregnancy and your labor and delivery. So I want to be home. I want to be with a midwife. I don't want any of this technology. And people have been doing this for hundreds of years, and I'm healthy. And they give all these wonderful stories of how great it was, too. So it's kind of interesting that I think we're really at these polar extremes.
Well, and there's a huge variation, I mean, as I understand it, obviously between the way that women experience labor and childbirth. I mean, there are some women who don't even feel labor pain.
There's women that say it's orgasmic. I have a few pages on that.
I worked with a woman who literally didn't feel her labor pains, and she ended up giving birth to her second child in the car in the hospital parking lot because she just didn't know that she was that close. And yet, obviously, there are other women who feel them acutely. There's just such a huge variation.
And we do know now that it's probably not because the one who felt pain is more neurotic or uptight and more modern and civilized.
Or the one who felt pain was less ready for motherhood.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
That it is. People have different levels of pain. It probably has to also do where the baby is. You know, you have these, you know, nerves running through you. And, you know, I know someone who the baby was lying sort of in a way that, you know, gave her excruciating back pain. So it probably has to do with the way the baby's lying, the size of the baby. And some of it probably does have to do with your fear of it all, but it's a very personal thing.
One of the things that, this was just a sort of a passing comment that you made in your book, but it really resonated with me. You have a chapter on what was called twilight sleep, which was this other fad, actually sort of ironically enough, fed by feminists of the early 20th century. And it was, the fad was for extreme drugging, in which case the woman would feel some pain, but would forget about it afterwards. So she would have to be restrained during the delivery because she would be writhing. And, but she thought, I guess, you know, there was this fad in which women said it was great afterwards because they couldn't remember. But the passing comment that you made was that, one of the so-called pluses for twilight sleep was that women only needed 10 days of recovery after labor, which was considered a short period at the time. And presumably before that, maybe it was even considered that women needed a couple of weeks. And I have to confess, when I read this, I did feel a little bit nostalgic for past eras when people did accept the idea that labor was a difficult ordeal and that a woman might need some help and some rest afterwards.
And to make the transition of being without a child to with a child, the whole emotional thing, we kind of forget about that.
Or even just the physical, the physical part, the getting used to caring for a child. And maybe because I was in this brief window of time with my first child when insurance companies were experimenting with sending us home a day after delivery. And I remember the doctor telling me, well, if your baby comes after 3 o'clock, you'll get an extra night in the hospital. But she came at about 1:30. So she was born at 1:30 in the afternoon, and I was out of there the next day before noon. I mean, really less than 24 hours. You know, they had me in a wheelchair, and we were strapping her into the car seat, and she had jaundice, and we had to bring her back, et cetera. But it really, it made me think again that maybe we are a little too complacent about the process and the idea that it is like having kittens or something, that it is just this easy, instinctive process.
And well, I think we focus, well, at least in our country, I think we focus on healthy baby. Like, I mean, that's a good focus. I mean, I think we focus on, okay, the baby came out, baby looks fine, passed all the tests, okay, you're out of here.
Yeah.
Which is okay. But I do think I gave birth to my first child in England. And what they do there, which I think is the most wonderful system, is we went home pretty much right away. But everyone in England, no matter, I was doing it through the National Health Service, but however whether you're in an NHS hospital, wherever you gave birth, everyone gets visited by a midwife for the first 10 days. And I have to say, I was dreading it because I thought, I don't know, I just pictured this woman in this starched white thing.
She'd be judgmental.
I thought she'd be so judgmental. And I thought she was going to say, here's the schedule that for feeding and sleeping and, you know, put all these rules. Anyhow, the most wonderfully nice person came into my apartment and she said, and we talked, how's everything going? And she weighed my baby. And then if I had questions, like, where do you buy diapers? Where do you get this? I had no idea where to get anything in England. And she was just so nice. I started to look forward to her visits. And then we would just sort of chat about motherhood. So it was, you really felt connected to this community. I was so sad when 10 days finished. But now if they think you still, if she felt you still need support after 10 days, she'd keep coming. And the other thing they do, which I think we should start here. Maybe this will be my new activist thing. Then after the 10 days, she came back. She knocked on my door 6 weeks after birth, and she held the baby, and she said, this is all about you. and they wanted to know how it was transitioning into motherhood. And they'll do it for your second and third kids, and they talk to you, and they're actually, they actually have a specific, she makes it sound like they're just chatting, but they're actually a specific checklist to see if you have postpartum depression.
Right.
And then they will find you the right, you know, should you need extra help, they'll find you the right help. But I do think psychologically, there was this nice feeling of knowing that you weren't just being sent home. I mean, my second birth, I gave birth to twins here in the United States, and I basically left the hospital, and I was kind of like, okay, well, we're on our own. You know, I just had this weird feeling, like we just left, and no one else cared, and then the babies came out fine, and that was it.
Right, yeah, and it's up to you to bring them back to the
community. It's up to you, and it's not like in colonial days where you're going to have a ton of your friends and relatives like waiting at your house, you know, with food and stuff to hang out with you.
Right. Yeah, so again, I think sometimes that we've been lulled into the sense that it's easier than it is, really. And I remember when I was doing some reproductive-related reporting, spending time with some nurses and professionals who worked at a low-income reproductive clinic here in D.C., and they were instituting home visits with lower-income women to improve the outcomes for them and their children. But the idea of home visits was kind of an unusual one. I mean, this was considered something that you would do for at-risk households, which is a great thing, but it certainly wasn't considered something that you would do for every mother who had just brought home, you know, her first baby and had sort of no idea what to do or very little idea what to do.
No, because I think we focus on, you know, APGAR, we focus on all the sort of lists, like, okay, the baby weighs enough, the baby's eating, the baby's healthy, so therefore, you know, go see your pediatrician in 6 weeks and everything else will just fall into place and go back to work or do whatever you're doing, but it'll all fall into place.
Yeah. Now, another of the things that I'm very aware of in talking about all this is that we are talking about first world medicine and we're talking about childbirth being a relatively safe proposition now in first world countries. But this is obviously not the case in many developing countries where, as you said, where fistula remains a terrible problem for women and something that can make them pariahs, really.
And maternal mortality is still high. Actually, some of the reporting that I did on the book, and I don't delve into it a lot, and it's scattered through footnotes, but not only developing countries, but there are rural pockets in America where the statistics are just as bad as rural Africa.
No, that's extraordinary.
Yeah, and to me, it has to do with access to care. You know, here in our country, we don't have, you know, we don't have insurance for everyone to be getting all this prenatal care and going
to the doctor. Well, yeah, we haven't really talked about prenatal care. Is that what you're talking about with regard to?
I think both. Actually, I think it's both. I think it's prenatal, but it's also, you know, if you can't get to a hospital, if you're in labor and it's going to cost you money to get a taxi to get to a hospital, oftentimes you're not going. So I'm sure that's what's happening in rural America, and that's definitely what's happening in outback, you know, in the African continent and in a lot of other countries where there are women far away from any health facility and they just can't afford it. There's just no way they're going to get to the hospital. And so they have traditional birthing assistance, a lot of these women, which works well if everything goes okay. I mean, if everything goes okay, you don't really need any help. The only reason why we get help is just in case something goes wrong. But if you're far away and the person you're with doesn't know, doesn't have forceps, doesn't do C-sections or can't give oxygen to the baby when it's needed, then you're in big trouble.
And all of our sort of now centuries of technological advancement in this country, has it taught us things that could be applied to developing countries that could improve the situation and improve the outcome? Are there...
Well, it's interesting. There are organizations here in the U.S. that are, and I'm sure in other countries too, that are doing outreach in developing countries. And their mission is not to say, okay, how can we take all of our high-tech stuff and transport it over there? What they want to do, which I think is the most practical, because we're not going to build hospitals. I mean, we'd like to build hospitals and clinics, but a lot of these organizations, and I've spoken to a lot of nurses, say, well, what can we do now that's cheap and easy to do? And what they feel we should do is give these even 2-day training courses to these traditional birth assistants to say, here, you know, here are forceps or here's a vacuum extractor, which is something else that helps get the baby out. And maybe then you won't need the C-section. You know, that's what they're worried about when the baby gets stuck. Or here's a way to see if the mom might be in trouble early on. So then maybe you can get the mom to a hospital. But they're trying to figure out, I even spoke to one organization that said they're trying to possibly teach some of these women how to do C-sections, you know,
wow.
out of a clinic. I know. But that's the way. I mean, they're not talking getting high-tech stuff, but how can we use our low-tech mm-hmm. stuff mm-hmm. to make it safer for women?
And do you feel like we've gotten to a pretty good place? One of the themes in your book is sort of the, not even lifelong, but sort of history-long tension between midwives and the and sort of lower-tech, often female assistance to childbirth and sort of high-tech medicine. Do you feel like we've gotten to a pretty good place in this country in terms of the balance between the two?
No.
Oh. So what's no. it? Describe the
you
imbalance.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting to me the feedback I'm getting from the book, because I have people say that I've been too harsh on doctors, and I have people say that I've been too nice to doctors and too harsh on midwives. So I think if you're a midwife, I don't know, I guess it's whatever your sensitivities are. I tried to do the presented balance, but a lot of people, you know, I mean, there are people that think I'm too harsh on either side.
You mean they're judging?
They're judging. And I think that, I think there is still tension today. I think there's still definite tension where it's hard for midwives to get jobs. You know, I don't think there's respect for midwives in this country at all.
There's not.
And I think that there's a lot, you know, midwives today are not your granny midwives of 100 years ago. They're educated, they're trained, and they're also trained to know this is what's going on, and I know how to deliver a baby. And mm-hmm. any of the trained midwives today know when they need a doctor, when to say to a woman, you know what, this is really going in the wrong directions, and mm-hmm. I think that you're going to need emergency care, and let's get you to a hospital. You know, so, you know, I think midwives aren't saying we're going to go to extreme to prevent a woman from using technology. So I think midwives are very educated today, and they know what they're doing. They don't get a lot of respect in this country because I think there's still this image that they're uneducated and they're going to do whatever they can, even if it's dangerous for the woman, to prevent technology from coming in. So I definitely think there's still that tension.
So the general view is that midwives are going to be anti-technology. They're going to keep you home, and they're going to sort of inflict an ideology on even a laboring mother who needs hospitalization at a certain point.
I think that's a perception from
but
doctors.
It's not, right, a perception, but not
right.
true. Where do midwives train?
There are midwifery schools. You know, I think someone, I know there's one in Seattle, there's a good one, and I know there's places in New York. The problem now, talking to midwives, is getting jobs then. You know, ideally what midwives want to do now is to connect themselves with a doctor. So that way they can say, you want to be home and I'll be with you and I'll be by your side and I'll provide services that a doctor can't. And then here, worst case scenario, I have a number that we can call for emergency backup.
Right.
But it's harder for midwives to,
Is a midwife necessarily going to deliver a child at home, or might a midwife do a hospital delivery?
Well, that's hard. You know, well, I think it's easier for them to be able to do things at home. But again, you have to have hospital rights, you know, then it goes through all the hospital administration, and then you're impinging on, you know, it goes way back to the history of it. Then you're impinging on OBGYN turf. And they don't want that.
I see.
You know, the other weird thing that has something to do with what we're talking about, a little off, is that, you know, about 100 years ago, and I'm not sure why, whenever doctors got really angry, or some of them, they'd write these really nasty poems. In like medical journals, they'd write a poem against a doctor, a poem. And I found these like really anti-midwife rhyming poems. You know, so they did try to, you know, they always felt that midwives.
Can you quote from any of them? Do you remember?
Oh gosh.
What were they inveighing against? What were they angry about?
Oh, that they were getting the women. I mean, basically the theme was that you were in danger if you went to a midwife, that they're killing women. I mean, there was a poem about midwives killing women.
Wow.
Now, midwives said the same thing about doctors.
Right. So it hasn't, it's a tension that has not been resolved, although presumably both sort of...
Oh, here's a good one. Okay, I'll just... Okay, here's one. When midwives were worried about forceps, and a doctor wrote a poem in response, well, anyhow, it goes on basically talking about, you know, midwife. Well, basically, they were going back and forth about midwives killing. And I can't find it. Actually, I thought I found that poem, but it was a different poem that I found. They seemed to write poems. They were
Or were they bored in class or something? So they started writing anti-midwife poems?
No, they did. I guess they figured here. Well, okay, here it is. I'm talking about the midwives all whose heads are empty as a hall and through their dreadful negligence cause baby's head devoid of sense. So thus we see far and about official murder, there's no doubt. That was written around the 1500s.
Wow. Mm. Wow, that was a very threatened person who was writing that.
Right.
Because chances are back then it wasn't really midwives who were inflicting damage on them.
No,
childbirth itself, perhaps?
Yeah. No, yeah.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Well, as I said, your book, it really is fascinating to see the themes and tensions that have held.
Right, I said I like to think of it as the prequel to your book.
Oh, that's
everything
right.
conceivable, that's you know, right. is all the wacky things we're doing now and in the future. And then I did the prequel. Everything that we've
done up till now. Well, I have to say we're in the middle, as you may know, of an historic snowstorm and blizzard in Washington, and the roads are impassable. And I have to say I am wondering how laboring mothers are doing right now, and I haven't heard any news accounts yet, but I would imagine that there are some pretty dramatic situations. I'm hoping that people just got themselves to the hospitals or got their midwives to their houses a couple of days ago. So I'm hoping it's working out okay for everybody.
I'm sure the same thing's happening in New York right now.
Yes. Well, it was great to talk to you.
You too.
I enjoyed your book, and again, it just made me, I have to say, between both midwives and doctors, it just made me grateful that it has become so much of a safer proposition so that, you know, we can have our babies and live our lives and go forth into careers or whatever and look back and remember those days with such pleasure, because I must say I do. You know, I look back on my two children's births as really the most memorable days of my life, and I remember every minute. I'm so grateful that I can do that.
I feel the same.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, thank you. Thanks
Take care.
A lot.
All right, bye-bye.